One of the keys are women. We know that we make up for more than 50% of the population. Cannot be serious about when we talk about transforming the continent if we keep on excluding women. I'm not saying it because I'm an African woman. I'm saying it because it makes absolute economic sense. Exactly. We know that by boosting gender parity on the continent, this could help boost our gross domestic product by 12% by 2025. So it's essential to work on these issues to empower women.
So last week we shared part one of the chat with Ms. Maladu Kaba. In this episode, we delve into the here and now. We talk about COVID-19, we talk about the options for financing Africa's growth moving forward, as well as the lessons for people coming up in international development. It's a super insightful conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did putting this together. Let's listen into the chat. But earlier you mentioned sort of COVID-19, and this is, you know, it's kind of the elephant in the room. We cannot avoid that, no matter what we think. And lots of countries are trying to sort of emerge from the initial onslaught of COVID-19, right? The impact on economies, on, you know, society, like socioeconomic outcomes. What are some of the ways that African countries sort of need to be thinking about financing their recovery and charting a sustainable path to growth, given all the things that COVID-19 has taught us about, you know, the impact of the way things are at the moment?
First of all, I think we need to recognize that the pandemic has been, for us Africans, again, a nemesis. Mm. It has been a stark reminder of our vulnerabilities, and I wrote it in an article that I published actually early on in 2020 already. And what are these vulnerabilities? We do not trade with each other sufficiently. We know mm-hmm. that intra-African trade stands at a very low 16%. Against 60% in the Asian and European regions. We do not add value to what we grow or extract from our soils, which means that when we look at the goods and services that we trade, they are at the bottom of the value chains, and our economies are not diversified enough. And so COVID-19 has just reminded us that we need to boost economic integration. We need to work on our value chains.
Yeah.
And I think that the fact that the African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement went into force in January this year, I think this was a very good thing because it signals the strong will of our mm-hmm. leaders as well as their determination. And again, as I said, political will is very important. Yeah. But we need now to really boost, the many challenges that hinder economic integration. And these are working on integrating our infrastructure, whether we talk about ports, roads, airports. We need to also work on integrating our productive systems in order to, and for instance, we can do that by, looking at major economic project of economic interest. Mm-hmm. Europe did that with Airbus, for instance. You have different components of this plane that are being produced in different countries in the EU, and then it is assembled in Toulouse in France. Why can't we, for instance, think about, for instance, we are talking about vaccines. Mm-hmm. Africa has been left behind when it comes to vaccines. We see now, we have seen a very strong push and calls for different leaders on our continent, but also outside the continent, to seize that opportunity to finally find the ways to develop industries that would allow us to produce our own vaccines. We know that the vaccine for against malaria has been has been found. I think that these are opportunities that we really need to look up to. Cell phones. I think that I was on a panel last week in focusing on East Africa. They have already, they have this ability to, they have integrated their productive systems in a way. They also are very strong on integrated infrastructure. So I think that they can really move forward in terms also of producing cell phones. I think that this is an area where they really, some of the countries in that region can really work and make, you know, possible to produce cell phones made in Africa. So I mentioned the economic integration. The second point for me is obviously governance. And I'm looking back again at the CFTA, the African Continental Free Trade Area. This is a complex agreement, both in legal terms, but also when we look at the trade-related technicalities that it includes. And I used to say that, and I keep on saying that, the CFTA is a litmus test for our government and for our public administrations, because it will add a layer of complexity in governance and in reforms that we are already implementing, but for which, you know, we may have difficulties. And for me, the CFTA will really question our capacity to push for reforms, to accelerate the digital transformation agenda as well, because all this, I think, will be will benefit from more digitalization on the continent. Africa has made progress when we look at the e-government development index that was produced in 2020 by United Nations. Africa stands at 0.44 against a global average of 0.43. And so it means that we have made progress, but we still need to push through so that we become, so that we increase this process, because it will definitely help us. The number three is the informal sector. I think that we tend to forget sometimes. We know that our economies, the informal sector make up for 80 to 90% of our economies. These are huge numbers, and I believe that when we for me, one of the keys of the recovery will also be our ability to interact with the informal sector, but not the usual the usual way, which is pretty much driven by that financial orthodoxy. So don't get me wrong. I am in favor of financial orthodoxy, but I believe that if we are still talking about formalizing the informal sector today in the 21st century, that means that the way we've been approaching this has not worked. And one of the lessons for me of the COVID-19 pandemic is that we need to be counterintuitive. You know, we need to think out of the box. And for me, one of the ways to think out of the box when it comes to the informal sector is to ask ourselves, can't we keep on thinking that 80 to 90% of the population, are fraudsters? No, they aren't. But So for me, the real question here is, but what if the informal sector exists because of the failure of the public sector to deliver quality public services? And for me, this is really where we need to work. We need to have a bottom-up approach instead of having that top-down approach and saying that, no, we need to formalize them. That does not work.
Mm-hmm.
That does not work. They still account for the largest segments of our economies. They still employ large populations, including women and youth. So I think that we really need a new approach. We need to understand what are the failures of our systems, whether we talk about the banking sector, whether we talk about the business climate, whether we talk about basic infrastructure, electricity, roads, ports, telecommunications. Unless we make significant dents in improving these different areas I've just quoted, we will still having the informal sector. And other point relates, of course, to financing, which relates to your more directly to your question.
Mm-hmm.
I am in favor of homegrown solutions. And, you know, for me, it's a bit painful to see that our founding fathers in 1963, when they were in Addis Ababa, and I'm more particularly, of course, referring to the brilliant speech of late President Kwame Nkrumah. He said it all in his speech. He said that we must work on an African monetary fund. He talked about, you know, also private equity from Africa. When we know that Africa is home to about $2 trillion of private capital held by thousands of high net worth individuals, there is money. And even globally, there is money.
Yeah.
But the thing is that Africa does just get a drop in the ocean of that big chunk. Why? And for me, the answer lies in the risk perception. And we've seen it, actually. We see how this played out in full last year when we saw downgradings of some countries by rating agencies. And some developed economies had exactly the same situation, sometimes even worse, and they didn't get any downgrading. There's always these double standards. And I think it comes from the fact that we still do not own our narrative because we lack data. And so it drives this perception of, overly risky continent. But first, we need to stop thinking about Africa as a continent. It's 55 countries. Everyone is different. And secondly, I don't think that Africa may be more risky than any other regions in the world, but it is more related to the fact that we are lagging behind when it comes to having a high capacity of collecting data, analyzing data.
Yeah.
And so we need that to really, I think, to be able to attract those financial flows. I mean, more financial flows. But again, I think there's a lot also on the continent, and we need to develop this culture of investment funding, especially in the Francophone idea, in the Francophone area. I know that in Anglophone countries, this is already something that people are used to, but not necessarily in our Francophone countries, but these are, I believe, some of the issues and debt, of course, because debt has been also largely a topic last year and remains a topic this year.
Yeah.
I'm in favor. Countries can borrow, but what I want to stress here is that it is not necessarily whether you borrow or not that matters. What matters is what you borrow for. Are you borrowing to build vanity projects, to develop vanity projects, or are you borrowing to develop productive projects that will allow you to increase, to generate more wealth, to generate more income, to also widen your tax base, and therefore providing you with the necessary resources to pay back that debt in 20, 25 years, later. So again, I think that this comes back to also governance. You know, do we have the right processes to identify the right projects?
Yeah.
Are we able also to, select companies that will be able to deliver quality when it comes to building a road, a bridge, or even a dam? So I think that, it all boils down to governance. It all boils down to our capacity to deliver results when we are leading. Women, of course. I mean, last but not least, recovery also relies. One of the keys are women. We know that we make up for more than 50% of the population. We cannot be serious about when we talk about transforming the continent if we keep on excluding women.
Yeah.
And it makes, I'm not saying it because I'm an African woman, I'm saying it because it makes absolute economic sense.
Exactly.
We know that by boosting gender parity on the continent, this could help boost our gross domestic product by 12% by 2025. So it's essential to work on these issues, to empower women, to have more women in decision-making roles, to fight also against, you know, gender-based violence, because it doesn't help us at all. So for me, these are the keys of not only a economic for a strong economic post-COVID, post-COVID economic recovery, but for sustainable growth, inclusive growth, stronger growth for our continent in the coming in the coming decades.
I mean, my goodness, I am cheering so hard. I'm not sure what to do with myself right now. I thank you so much for these insights. We could talk for forever, but I'm definitely cognizant of the time. So to wrap this up, I think I just wanted to ask a few questions, right? If we're looking at the future, if we're looking at people coming up into this space, for instance, what if you were to pin it down to, let's say, two or three, you know, key things, what would you say that you wish you knew, or two or three things that you know now that you wish you knew and understood, let's say 20 or 25 years ago, I guess when you started out in this space? What do you wish you knew that maybe you would want other people to consider?
Oh, the first thing would be that I should have, while I was an employee, I should have started my own business on the side. I am now an entrepreneur, but it's how I'm gonna put it. I feel it's harder at 50, even though some people keep telling me, no, but you know better. You know, there are things that you know now that you didn't know before, mistake that you will not do. The second thing is related to my board journey. I just wonder how this simply just was not on my radar, maybe, 10 to 15 years ago. And the last thing, last but not least, definitely having a very strong network of sisters. And in this regard, I just would like to commend, Madame Sirleaf, who came up with this great idea about the Ellen Johnson Sirleaf Center for Women and Development, because I believe that this is a great opportunity to, first of all, the center aims to actually equip African women who aspire to leadership position in the public sector. And so, we have access to great mentors, coaches, women who have been trailblazers and who continue to trailblaze even today, with former presidents, with also people such as Dr. Ngozi, Dr. Vera Songwe, and so many amazing African elders that we have. So for me, yeah, building, having really that network of sisterhood around me, you know, to protect me, but also to share views about, you know, the challenges that we face, and also the ideas that we have. I wish I had that, especially when I was a minister. Yeah. But it's not too late. I have it now. So, you know, and my journey continues.
Excellent. One thing I wanted to ask with regards to what you said, right? So the first point, you talked about sort of your board journey. You talked about having something on the side. Like, what are some of the areas that maybe, if you could, you would go into in terms of things on the side? Also, your board journey, what does that mean for people who are listening? How can you start to be more strategic around that? What does it look like seeking that, and even building, you know, sisterhood, even in people that have sort of similar aspirations, right? So maybe you may not have attained the level that would, you know, qualify you for something like what you have with the Amuje Initiative, but what does it look like building that for yourself? So if you could draw a little bit of attention to, like, the how you'd go around doing some of these things and the spaces you'd have thought about, so that would be great.
In terms of the board journey, I think, because, you know, when I think about my own experience, I remember that I would hear men, you know, saying, oh, I'm in a board, but I never even asked. And it just amazes me why it never crossed my mind at that time. But I think that was before. And again, things are different today. I think that these things are really getting more attention and focus. Yeah. And as a young aspiring leader, whether you are a young man or a young woman, I think that it is interesting to get into a board, even if people tend to say that you need experience. But at the same time, you also need diversity. Yeah. And when we know that, for instance, on our continent, you know, 70% of our population is very young, it makes absolute sense to try and get first-hand experience, maybe starting with a not-for-profit organization that will give you already a first experience of understanding what it is to be in an organization. How can we steer its governance, its strategy? I think this is a first thing to do. So you need first, of course, to document yourself. That's very important to get to know what it is, what it entails, what are your duties, what are your responsibilities. Yeah. And there are so many organizations today that can help you with this, but you need to document yourself. Then you need to have a strategy on how to get on the board. Look also into your network. I'm sure that there are a couple of people that may be, you know, in some boards. And then strategize, you know, meet with people, understand what it is, and prepare yourself. There are also courses, there are institutions that deliver, you know, courses for you to also better understand the role as a board member. When it comes to the sisterhood, there are always, I mean, yeah, as women, we are not very good with network. But here again, I think that today that there is a stronger realization that we need to be together. Yeah. We need to come up together so that by being together, we will be stronger to make ourselves heard. We will be stronger to really push forward for agendas that really need to be changed. Especially, for instance, you know, if I take the gender-based violence, I've been helping recently an NGO, and I've been very, very vocal about, you know, women's participation in the political transition in my country. Recently, we had an absolutely horrifying case of rape, which unfortunately is not the only cases. But we, you know, it's important that, and we are trying to organize ourselves so that we will make our voice heard, because we can no longer accept that. So I think it's also about trying to identify sisters, you know, which you believe have the same goals, want the same things, while also being diverse. I think it's important to keep the diversity and build build that bond. You know, I'm part of different networks on the continent and on different areas in different that this is how you do it. You know, identify the sisters, and it's very easy today with the social network and so many other digital platforms. This would be my some of my advice.
No, that's excellent. Thank you. Thank you so much. And the last thing, you've talked about some of it already, but drawing on your lessons, right, from the last, you know, 25 years in the development space, what would you say your message is to young people coming of age, looking to impact their countries, but are feeling a little discouraged by existing models of governance and even government? Like, what would your message to them be right now in, you know, November 2021?
Oh, I would say it's important to know your subject. It's important to master your craft. I think that it's also key to understand the social and cultural fabrics of our country. I mean, if I take my case, for instance, you know, I wasn't born in Guinea. I wasn't raised in Guinea. I grew up in France, so I also, and I think it's still an ongoing process. It's very important for me to get to understand, you know, the social fabrics, because it permeates everything we do here. I think it's also important to own our narrative, tell your story. Don't let anyone tell it, you know, at your, in your place. Mm. You need to be fierce, you need to be proud of yourself, and you need to work very hard. Because again, and to challenge, you know, that perception that we often see on social media, that things can be done very easily, that you get to the top with the lift. No, you don't. And that's why I'm saying, I'm coming back to my first point, which is that life is definitely a marathon, and you need a lot of stamina. Stamina is important, and you get stamina with two things. I mean, for me, in my case, it worked. It's faith and sports that gave me the discipline to face the many challenges in my life. I would also say that common sense is key, especially in the development world, because sometimes you, and I'm not saying, I don't want to offend those, you know, graduating from Ivy Leagues universities, but sometimes you don't need a PhD from Harvard or Yale or whatever. I have the utmost respect for these institutions, but sometimes common sense is just so much more effective. And it will, and I think that, yeah, I mean, the diplomas will never make up for your character. So I think, and last but not least, follow what, you know, artists and people in the entertainment industry do, because especially on our continent, they have broken so many barriers, and they are so creative. And there is so much to learn. I believe that there are two industries that you can learn a lot about. So one is not very funny. It's the defense industry, in terms of creativity and innovation, I'm saying. The defense industry. But another one which is absolutely fun is, of course, the entertainment industry. We see our many of our artists doing collabos, you know, from the Anglophone world and from the Francophone world. They have broken those barriers long time ago. And so for me, it is so inspiring when we talk about our continent as a in terms of unity. And again, I mean, I will end up with this. Go back to basics. Kwame Nkrumah said it. President Kwame Nkrumah said it. We must unite now or perish. I love this sentence, and I think they said it all. So go back to basics as well. This is good.
Miss Malado Kaba, I could talk to you for ages. Thank you. Thank you so much. I think this has actually been the longest podcast we've done, and that's because I enjoyed every single thing that we've spoken about today. So really, thank you for the openness to share your experiences, the lessons you've learned, and your journey so far. We are very grateful for this chat. And I hope that people listening do learn a lot and listen as many times as is needed to pick all these nuggets that you've put out there today. So again, thank you. Thank you so much for this chat. It's been absolutely wonderful.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to transfer a little bit of my knowledge. But it's been also, it's been fun going back to some memories. I mean, remembering some things. Thank you so much for this opportunity. And I hope it will be helpful.
Oh, I'm certain it will be. Thank you.
Okay.
All too soon, we've come to the end of today's episode with Miss Malado Kaba. Don't forget to share this episode with others and follow our social media channels to be kept updated on future episodes, as well as the other publications that we put out here at the Brentes Foundation. As always, thank you so much for listening. It's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. And until next week, it's goodbye. Stay well.